Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Partnership Program, our guest today, Robin Muncy, is an expert on the 19th Amendment.
The 19th Amendment was the one that said that no state could deny the vote on the basis of sex. And we're going to look at what that meant in the short term, like in the 1920s in particular.
That, of course, is our guest today, Robin Muncy, who will be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates Program June 7th, 2017 in Washington, D.C. at the Ripley Center. Robin will be presenting on the subject, The Women's Vote, the 19th Amendment and its Aftermath. This is part of the Smithsonian Associates' Daring to be Modern programming. Robin maintains that as women gained the vote in the States, they began changing the very meaning of what it was to be a woman. In quotes, Robin says, "Women were changing the meaning of womanhood. They're changing the meaning of democratic citizenship for women. That is no small thing." Robin Muncy is a fascinating guest, and I'm certain you'll love this interview. I learned a great deal from Robin, who's a full professor in the Department of History at the University of Maryland. Robin is a talented presenter. You're going to want to see this program, and Robin has been featured on CNN, PBS, C-SPAN, and has done film work. Please join me in welcoming Robin Muncy to the Not Old Better Show Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series. Well, Robin Muncy, what a pleasure it is to talk to you, and certainly the subject is timely, but why don't you do a brief self-introduction? Tell us a little bit about the program coming up on June 7th, Smithsonian Associates at Ripley Center, and then tell us a little bit about you, too.
All right. Thank you so much, Paul. I'm thrilled to be here. The program that I'm doing at the Smithsonian is about the kind of meaning of the 19th Amendment. The 19th Amendment was the one that said that no state could deny the vote on the basis of sex. And we're going to look at what that meant in the short term, like in the 1920s in particular. I am currently interim chair of women's studies at the University of Maryland in College Park. And my usual perch is as professor of history here at College Park. But for 18 months, I've been serving as interim chair in women's studies, and it's been a great delight. And so I'm very interested in suffrage and the long history of struggles over suffrage for women and for other Americans as well.
And there have been a lot of struggles on this subject. I think my audience is going to be familiar, certainly, with the 19th Amendment, probably a bit familiar with the 14th Amendment. But, you know, there were many who thought, look, we've got the right to vote, albeit limited. Before the amendment passed, women were voting. What should we know about that period, kind of in between the 14th Amendment and maybe better put, what should we know about that period kind of leading up to the 19th Amendment when Susan B. Anthony were working so hard and many were really trying to accomplish this and make a point that we just don't have it right yet?
One of the points to make, think about the amendment, is that it represented a victory of American women's existing political power. That is, it, and we usually think about it kind of in shorthand. We say, oh, in 1920, American women got the vote. But in fact, millions of American women already had the vote before the 19th Amendment. And it's impossible to imagine that the 19th Amendment would have been passed through Congress and ratified by the states if millions of women were not already voting in many states across the country. So in that period, in the late 19th century and through the early 20th, leading up to the passage of the 19th Amendment by Congress in 1919 and the ratification of the amendment in 1920. In all those decades, women were working and their allies were working on the ground in states and counties trying to urge their state legislators or voters in their states to enfranchise them in their particular states. And in the 19th century, four states in the West fully enfranchised the women in their states. And then after the turn of the century, most of the Western states, in fact, had enfranchised women fully before the 19th Amendment. And then even some big states in the East, like New York, enfranchised its women in 1917. And so, I mean, as you look at the way that congressmen voted on the federal amendment, if you look at that over time, you see that the more women were voting in their states, the more congressmen were likely to vote for the federal amendment here in Washington. And so it is just really hard to imagine that the 19th Amendment wouldn't have passed had so many women not already been voting and exercising political power through their states beforehand.
We're with Robin Muncy. Robin is going to be speaking at Smithsonian Associates on June 7th, 2017. The title of Robin's talk, The Women's Vote, The 19th Amendment and Its Aftermath. And it's part of the Daring to be Modern programming. This period, right around 1920, and suffrage and all that went on, has very much a local kind of connection. There's a picture, we'll link to it, on the Smithsonian Associates website page of the silent sentinels that are posted outside of Washington, D.C. This wasn't necessarily a simple process for the silent sentinels, for women like Lucy Burns, who has a local connection to the Occoquan Workhouse here in Virginia. There were hunger strikes. Women were being force-fed around this issue. This was kind of some precursor to the Equal Rights Amendment, but this was really, it got out of hand very quickly. And I'm sure that these are subjects that you're bound to be touching on, but I wonder if you just react to some of that.
Yeah, I mean, we can see the late 19th century and the early 20th century as a period when women's political power was increasing, you know, little by little, state by state. But there was a lot of resistance to it in a lot of places, obviously, because many states, of course, didn't enfranchise women through state action. They're resisting. And so it took the 19th Amendment to enfranchise women in those states. There are a lot of states, too, states that we think of as very progressive, like Massachusetts, for instance, which only had partial suffrage for women. Illinois only partially had enfranchised women before the federal amendment. There's a lot of resistance. And so when we get closer and closer to the moment of ratification, it's true that there are huge marches, and there were women who, in the National Women's Party, who chained themselves to the White House fence in the late teens, demanding the vote for women. They were the people who got arrested and taken out to the workhouse in Virginia and were force-fed. They endured just, you know, hideous, violent treatment in order to try to win the vote. And the women who engaged in those or participated in those huge marches, huge demonstrations, and who were force-fed, did draw enormous attention, enormous publicity to the cause of women's suffrage in the late teens. But I think in my own telling of the story and in my own understanding of the process by which suffrage was won, I really emphasize the kind of on-the-ground, patient, long-haul struggle of women in their precincts, rather than the more dramatic moments that involve things like marches, demonstrations, and the force feeding out at Occoquan. It's not that I think that those are unimportant, but I think what one suffered, the fundamental explanation for the victory of the 19th Amendment, is women's voting in the states. So I see that sort of patient on the ground, actually not very dramatic, a story as the crucial one to understanding how profound political change happens.
One profound comment that I read from you was from Mashable. Again, we'll put this this link up. And you said that the 19th Amendment changed the meaning of womanhood in America. It diminished gender difference. Tell us a little bit about what that quote really means to you.
Yeah. The way I see it is that the early 20th century was a moment when you're seeing the transition from a Victorian gender system to the modern gender system. And by gender system, I simply refer to kind of ideals of manhood and womanhood. You know, what is an ideal woman? What is an ideal man? And in the Victorian period, in the 19th century, the vision of woman, the dominant vision of manhood and womanhood, was that men and women were opposites. They were completely different from each other. You know, men were competitive, women were cooperative. Men were active, women were passive. Men were independent, women were dependent. So the Victorian system drew women and men as fundamentally different from each other. So the enfranchisement of women recognized and made women more like men than they had been before the vote.
And it really, it diminished this gender difference by creating really voters. And as some of the male elected officials, I mean, we're going to be in a political town, certainly you're going to be downtown Washington, D.C., and yes. Politicians being politicians, at the time, male elected officials hoped to appeal to this new class of voter. And from the standpoint of kind of your expertise on reform during this period, which priorities changed dramatically on kind of a national level once women began to not necessarily vote as a bloc, but certainly begin to weigh in on some of these issues?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. I love that question because it was the case that right after the amendment was ratified in 1920, between 1920 and then to the presidential election in 1924, a lot of men in Congress, the U.S. Congress, did believe and did fear that women would vote as a bloc. And so it's in that immediate period after the ratification of the 19th Amendment, progressive, really well-organized progressive women had much more power than they would have for a long time thereafter. There's a period, kind of a golden moment in that early 1920s period when Congress feared them, and they got some social welfare policies passed that it's hard to imagine would have passed without this fear. So, for instance, the most obvious example would be the passage in 1921 of the Shepherd-Towner Maternity and Infancy Act. Mm-hmm. The Maternity and Infancy Act was aimed at diminishing maternal and infant mortality rates. You may well know that in the early 20th century, the U.S. had some of the highest maternal and infant mortality rates of the entire industrialized world, and it still does. And there's a bureau created in the Federal Department of Labor. It was called the Children's Bureau, and it was headed by a woman, an activist called Julia Lathrop, who had done a lot of work, a lot of study of maternal and infant mortality rates, and she thought she had a way to reduce them. And she drafted this piece of legislation and brought it before Congress right after the ratification of the 19th Amendment, and fearful that they would be voted out of office if they didn't go along with what they saw as this women's priority, men in Congress voted for the Shepherd-Towner Maternity and Infancy Act. They passed the first piece of federal social welfare policy legislation. Quite amazing. And they actually said, we have documents that show those congressmen saying they would never have voted for this if they hadn't felt so pressured by the women in their states, and if they weren't so afraid of being voted out of office by the women in their states if they didn't vote for it. And what the Maternity and Infancy Act did was to provide federal money to the states to hire public health nurses generally. This was kind of the main thrust. The states would hire public health nurses to go around, especially to rural areas where there wasn't a lot of pediatric or obstetrical care. So these nurses would go out and they would examine. They would have sort of county health fairs where they would examine pregnant women. They would examine babies, toddlers, and teach women how to take better care of themselves while they were pregnant and to take care of their children when they were especially young. And all but three states ultimately participated in the Shepherd-Towner Act. And in this, though you can't determine causation directly, it is certainly the case that in the places where the Shepherd-Towner Act was implemented in the 1920s, maternal and infant mortality rates did decline. You can't be sure it's because of the act, but certainly there is a correlation between implementation of the act and the reduction of maternal and infant mortality rates in the 1920s. So, but by the time we get to the late 1920s, men in Congress had discovered that women mostly did not vote as a bloc, that they usually voted pretty much like the men in their class or their race. And so they were no longer fearful of this women's bloc. And in 1929, Congress let the funding for the Maternity and Infancy Act lapse. That initial foray of the federal government into social welfare came as a result of the 19th Amendment and the fear of Congress that they'd be voted out of office if they didn't go along with what they imagined to be a women's voting bloc that turned out not to be.
This is just a fascinating subject. And Robin Muncy, your expertise and your passion just comes through. On June 7th, 2017, Robin Muncy will be at Smithsonian Associates. I'm going to be there. I think this is the kind of subject that my audience is going to be very, very interested in. And in particular, Robin, I want to jump ahead just a little bit and maybe talk about today a little bit. We certainly have Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany. We have Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. We're almost 100 years after the 19th Amendment passed. Are we making the kind of progress that you think was envisioned by the 19th Amendment? Did suffrage help? Are leadership programs and kind of issues surfacing enough? Are programs like Emily's List doing enough to reach out to women? Are we as a country where we kind of need to be with regard to women in solving some of these issues that we're facing as a country?
Absolutely not would be the answer to that question, in my view. I think we've got a really long way to go. And when you look at the U.S. Congress, for instance, I mean, 20% of the U.S. Congress is female. 20% when women are, you know, over 50% of the population. So we've got a long way to go. It's turned out that politics has been one of the toughest nuts for women to crack, really. They haven't had trouble participating as voters, as organizers. They've had better luck participating in the party system than in getting elected to office. And most of the studies right now show that women actually have a good chance of being elected once they're running. The big gap between women and men in politics, as I understand it, comes at the moment of deciding to run. That is, many fewer women decide to run for office than men. And so one of the things that Emily's List is doing right now, which I think is just terrific, is really working hard to recruit women to run for offices at the local, state, and federal level, and offering support for them to do that, because women are just much less likely than men to put themselves forward as elected officials. So I do think we're going to see more success in that area, more equality in that area down the line, but we have a really long way to go, really long way to go. And, you know, it was clear in the 1920s, immediately after the passage of the 19th Amendment and its ratification, it was clear that that wasn't going to solve a lot of things, that women were going to have to continue to struggle like crazy to achieve parity within the political parties, within the elective process. They had better luck with appointments. In some presidential administrations, for instance, under Franklin Roosevelt, for instance, I mean, women did pretty well in appointive office, true under Truman as well. But it's elective office has really been a difficult barrier to overcome, and we have not succeeded yet. But I do think that groups like Emily's List are on the right track and are doing terrific work.
One of the other quotes that I found from you that I thought was so great, in addition to the changing the meaning of womanhood quote, was this quote where you say, they're changing the meaning of democratic citizenship for women. And that's no small thing. Mm-hmm. Really, this we probably do have a long way to go still, but it's a work in progress, and there are strategies being implemented. Emily's List is one. What are some others that you can share with us here?
I guess there's a lot of work going on campuses like my own, mm-hmm. Which provide kind of leadership workshops for women, and even something like having a women's studies major and a PhD in women's studies, you know, suggests, kind of embodies a hope and expectation of women's leadership across the board, you know, in every aspect of life, including politics. So I think that we could look to campuses for some of that as well. But there are organizations like the Feminist Majority, also working to empower women and to help them understand they have leadership skills that they often think that they don't have. There are organizations like the AAUW, the American Association of University Women, that also is very eager to increase the representation of women in politics and in a point of office as well, and is working on the gender wage gap and that kind of thing. So there are a really wide range of organizations working on this. I think in some ways, you know, following the Women's March earlier this year, there is a terrific intersectional feminist movement that is emphasizing a wider range of issues as women's issues. And I see so much hope in that, the aftermath of that march and the kinds of organizational initiatives that are emerging from this very diverse group of women.
The Women's Vote, the 19th Amendment and its Aftermath. Robin Muncy has been our guest today. Robin is going to be at the Smithsonian Associates Ripley Center June 7th, 2017 for what is going to be just a wonderful conversation about this subject. I think we're going to hear an awful lot about the aftermath, and there's certainly much more to discuss. But Robin, it's just been a pleasure to talk to you. Someone so well-informed about this subject. I think it's important that we not forget, but that we look forward for all of this. So thank you, Robin Muncy, for being our guest today.
Thank you so much, Paul. I've been delighted to be with you.
And we're looking forward to seeing you there on June 7th at the Ripley Center.
Thank you. I look forward to it, too.
Thanks, Robin.
Bye-bye.
Bye.